Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf at Adam. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Vilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can't fully understand the moment we're living in without knowing where we've been. On every episode of NPR's Throughline, we take a story from the news and go back in time to where it started, where it really started. To answer one important question, how did we get here? Find NPR's Throughline on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says we don't need no education. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Volkebon.
And I'm Joe McCormick. It took me a minute to get that one.
Well, it's because of the double negative.
It always trips me up.
Yeah. Hi, we're going to talk today about something that's related to topics we've addressed in the past, right? We've talked about innovations in architecture in previous episodes of Forward Thinking. Today, we're going to kind of get a little more granular. We're actually looking at the future of the materials we use to build stuff. Mostly
granular.
Like buildings.
Was that an aggregate pun?
It could be. It wasn't intended to be, but really.
But it kind of is.
Yeah, once you make a pun, whether you intended it or not, it's kind of the world.
You've unleashed it upon the world. And
yeah.
The world's to do with what they will.
Yeah, but we really have. We've talked about lots of futuristic methods of putting together buildings. We've talked about architecture. We've talked about 3D printing of whole houses.
Yep.
What else? I mean, lots of crazy stuff.
Yeah, some of the modular stuff that people are exploring. You know, the high quality, low environmental impact prefabrication that people are doing. And of course, those techniques are going to help shape what materials are used in the future. But let us talk today about specifically those materials, because material science is so much fun.
Yeah.
Let's get it down to a weird particulate level.
And you know, and it's important too,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
When you think about it, it's almost like everything is made out of materials.
Yeah, it's
it's almost like the universe is largely material in nature.
Well,
just about.
We're living in a material world.
Uh-huh.
And you are a material girl.
And, you know.
And you got to live in a material house. So thinking about materials is very important when it comes to how we build our cities.
Sure.
From the individual home to the skyscraper.
To other planet habitat.
Oh, sure. But it's especially important to think about all of that kind of stuff, because the things that we have been classically using throughout history to construct our stuff is not sustainable, and it's especially going to be less and less sustainable as the population and especially the urban population grows.
Yeah, so let's think about some of the materials that we use most often to build our buildings.
Okay, so there's straw, there's sticks,
right,
and there's bricks that yes. keeps the wolves out.
At least one of them. But no. Let's think like we got wood.
Yes.
You got steel.
Yep.
You got concrete. Those
mm-hmm.
are big. Glass, mm-hmm. brick and mortar. These are the old standbys, the hits.
Sure. Yeah. Not everyone lives in a yurt.
Right. But there are ways that we could think of to not only improve our methods of using these greatest hits of the building materials catalog, but also to branch out into totally different areas of
right.
Coming up with hard, sturdy stuff to make the walls around us out of. But before we do that, I think we should look at what the motivation for this discussion would be. I mean, you might be thinking, well, I don't know, what the heck's wrong with concrete? We already make stuff out of concrete. That seems fine.
Why don't we just cover the whole world in concrete?
Yeah. Why don't we make boats out of concrete?
Okay, well, that one I think we can more easily dismiss. But
why don't we make computers out of concrete?
Aww.
I'm just saying.
You know, let's talk about the problems, the challenges we face relying on a substance like concrete. Now, first of all, we have to admit, concrete was an amazing technological achievement, right? Without concrete, the world would not be the way it is.
Sure. And so concrete is made by binding together aggregate material with water and cement. It's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, an aggregate material could literally be anything from crushed shells to small rocks to sand.
Gravel, sand, whatever. And while so the real technology we're talking about here is cement.
Sure.
The idea of cement. And you, what you say is correct. Cement is an amazing technology that has made much of human civilization possible, but it does have its problems. For one thing, it is incredibly energy intensive to produce.
Mm-hmm.
According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, as of July 2013, the cement industry was the single most energy hungry of all manufacturing industries in the United States.
Wow. Yeah, and that energy that it's using is not really green energy, particularly.
No, it tends to rely heavily on coal and on petroleum coke. And coke, that's not the soft drink, not the stuff that is a refreshing way to taste the feeling.
It is, however, the real thing.
It sort of is, yeah. It's a high-carbon, low-hydrogen petroleum residue.
Yeah,
it's not especially refreshing.
The way you make coke, typically, is that you put, essentially, you put coal in an oven.
Mm-hmm.
And you heat coal up to a very high temperature, and you end up with this almost kind of, it looks very spongy and porous substance. That is coke. So it's really another stage of coal. It is a fossil fuel, which means it has all the trappings of other fossil fuels, including the fact that when you use it in combustion or even use it in any kind of firing capacity, you're releasing carbon.
Right, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. But back to the energy consumption. In 2012, according to that same EIA report, the cement industry alone accounted for 0.25% of all U.S. energy consumption. So you might be thinking, 0.25%.
0.25%.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like all that much, really. But you would be wrong. This is just one single industry against the background of all transportation, heating, grid energy, cars, everything. And when you think about it in those terms, that's huge. That's enormous.
Mm-hmm.
And it represents, in the words of that EIA report, quote, a share of national energy use roughly 10 times its share of the nation's gross output of goods and services. On average, other energy intensive industries' share of energy use is roughly twice their share of gross output. So that's comparing its role in the economy to how much energy it consumes.
So it's real inefficient.
Yeah, you might say that.
Gotcha. So in other words, the value we get from the production does not necessarily justify the energy cost of producing it compared to other types of products.
Right. Well, I mean, you might say it justifies it in that cement is just ubiquitous
yes.
around the world. It's one of the most used products out there. And the EIA also predicted that increasing energy use from the cement industry is going to continue into the future.
Right.
It's a growing trend.
Yeah. I mean, as urbanization happens, as we have talked about a lot, people like building urban environments out of cement because it's sturdy and it's great.
Yeah. Yeah. So why does cement use so much energy to produce? What are they doing? Are they like, do they have to detonate a volcano every time they,
not every time. It's like alternate Thursdays.
Yeah. That's only for fun.
What does the process look like?
I'll get into a little more detail with cement. So the most common type of cement around the world is called Portland cement. So it enjoys coffee, beards, and flannel. Why does it require so much energy? Well, it's a chemical combination of stuff like calcium, silicon. You're cracking
you're
up.
You're just
in my
killing phone. Me with those 2009 jokes.
Look, I'm a product of my time, and that's, you know, the dad jokes are going to be related back
okay.
by
you're
about
allowed.
A decade.
You're allowed.
But yes, it's a chemical combination of stuff like calcium, silicon, aluminum, iron, and some other stuff. Raw materials that are used to make cement include limestone, shells, chalk and shale, clay, slate, slag, which is essentially runoff from other manufacturing processes, silica sand, and iron ore. So you take all these different ingredients, and you need to put them into a furnace or a kiln and subject them to incredibly high temperatures. That people usually refer to this as like a heating and firing process.
And not just for a few minutes,
no,
right?
No, it's for a very long sustained period, and it often requires multiple heating and firing sessions. So it's not like you put the stuff in, you turn the temperature up to, you know, 1,000 degrees and you walk off and 20 minutes later, hey, you got cement.
Ding.
That's not the way it works.
No.
So because you have to heat this stuff up to such a high temperature, that's where a lot of this energy consumption is coming from, that you have to get the temperature up to a certain level and sustain it for a good long while.
What's the point of heating it to such a high temperature? What does it do?
It turns this collection of materials, and again, it's not like cement is going to contain all of the things I listed, but it's going to contain a collection of those things.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to heat all of that up, and it's going to end up creating a substance that's sort of rock-like. And this is, in fact, cement. But in order to make it usable, you have to grind that stuff down into powder. So that requires more energy, obviously, to convert the rock into the powder version. That's what you end up mixing with the aggregate and water. It becomes the binding agent. So that's dry cement. If you were to mix water with that, you would get wet cement. And that is part of why it requires so much energy. There's another component of energy that isn't addressed by this process, but it is, in fact, a very important thing that we have to keep in mind. And something that Joe, you wrote about in the video episode we did on this subject. That's the fact that not only do you have to put in a lot of energy to produce cement, but then you have to use even more energy to get it to where it needs to go.
Yeah.
Right? So you're actually spending even more energy to transport this finished
yeah.
product.
Oh, because you just made powdered rocks.
Yeah.
Those aren't light.
Right.
I mean, it's lighter than wet rock cement,
yeah,
suppose.
By the subtraction of
they
water.
They should ship the cement wet.
Well,
it's my idea.
On top of the fact that it's heavy.
Well, that's what cement trucks are. I mean, they do that sometimes.
Right. on top of the fact, and you got to pour that cement out by a certain amount of time or else it becomes dry in one of those cement trucks, and that's a mess. But
there was a Mythbusters episode
about trying to blow one up.
Yeah,
yeah, it was pretty impressive. But I was going to add that not only is it heavy, but your average construction project needs a crap ton of the stuff,
mm-hmm. yeah.
right? So it is a non-trivial issue that not only does it take a lot of energy to create the stuff, it takes a lot of energy to get it to where it needs to be.
Well, mm-hmm. let us emphasize how non-trivial this is. So we mentioned earlier that there are carbon emissions. Exactly how much? Do we know?
Well, according to a group of studies that was conducted through Columbia University circa 2012, collectively this group of studies was called State of the Planet, if you want to look it up. It's pretty fascinating. The cement industry is responsible for 5% of global carbon dioxide emissions.
Right.
That's no joke.
One
so
industry
much.
Responsible for 5%.
Yeah, and part of the reason there is that we are using so much cement. I mean, okay, like we said this like kind of in passing, but to give you a number, according to a report from 2009 from the World Business Council for Sustainable Development, concrete is the second most consumed material in the world every year after only water. And by consumed, I don't mean that we're all rock biters. I just mean that we're making a lot of it and we're putting a lot of it to use.
Right. Well, this rock biter would like to issue a little defense, because I don't think that our purpose today is to say, hey, we need to stop using cement to make concrete to make our buildings. That's not exactly the point. But I would say that if we can replace some portion of our share of traditional cement and concrete with better, more sustainable materials that create structures that are just as safe and get the job done, that would be a very good thing.
Yeah. This Falcor agrees with you.
Rockbiter isn't just a fun insult. It's a reference to
never ending story. All right. So never ending story references aside, and trust me, we could do an entire podcast of them.
What is the future of never ending story references?
Apparently it will go on forever based upon the title. So at any rate, let's talk about some ways to make concrete more sustainable, or to make concrete last even longer, so it helps justify the process of making it in the first place, right? So if we can either make better concrete where it requires less energy to create, or we make concrete that lasts longer, so therefore the investment we make is quote-unquote worth it, that's the first step. So let me talk about a few of those. So one thing we can look at is, are there ways to make concrete itself better? Right. As opposed to going to a complete alternative, are there things that we can do that either make concrete last longer, so therefore the energy investment that we make at the beginning pays off over a longer amount of time, yeah, or that we can decrease the ecological impact of creating the concrete in the first place? So we started looking into some of this stuff. One thing we wanted to talk about was the ability to make stronger types of concrete. So this idea that it could last a longer time. It could hold a greater load. I read a lot of very cynical forum posts from people who work in the concrete business and talked about different alternatives to your standard approach to a concrete mix for stuff like roads or sidewalks. And it almost always came into a thing where we said we would recommend using this particular type of mixture because it would last a longer amount of time. And the response we would get back is, but we need to have a job in 10 years. Oof. So we want to make sure we have to replace this.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I don't know how serious they were being, but I was seeing it pop up in multiple forums as I was looking into this. By the way, people who work with concrete, they are a very funny group that has an incredibly dry sense of humor. Anyway, concrete tends to be very, very resistant to compression. Like, it's good at standing up to compression, but not so much with tensile strength. In other words, when you're pulling along concrete, it tends to tear apart unless you mix it with something else. So one way to make stronger concrete is to increase the amount of cement you add, but we just talked about how cement is an energy-intensive material, right, to create cement. But if you wanted to make stronger concrete, you could add more cement to your cement to aggregate ratio. For example, some people might say, instead of making that a 4-bag mix, make it a 5-bag mix. In other words, adding an extra bag of cement for the same volume of concrete. So adding more cement is not necessarily the best choice, but you can do other things, like you can create mixtures in the concrete that increase its strength. For example, carbon fibers. We've talked about these. They're very lightweight. They have incredible strength. They specifically will add tensile strength to a material. If you do that with concrete, you get what is called fiberated concrete. It's a weird word because it's not really a word, but that's what they call it in the biz.
It's a word now.
And I guess so. They also have polymer concrete. So they're adding polymers. Those are those long chain molecules. We've talked about plastic being the famous polymer. And they'll use polymers to either offset or even completely replace cement as the binding agent. So you could have a concrete where polymers are the binder, not cement. And that is potentially better, but again, it depends on how you're producing the polymers. If it's all petroleum-based, you're really just, again, shifting some stuff over. It may not be a net gain.
Right.
And part of the issue here is that if you can't make it an affordable alternative to the pre-existing approach of concrete, then from a financial standpoint, it's very hard to justify, right? if you're a company and you're looking to make a profit out of building a project for a customer, then one of the ways you can maximize your profits is minimizing your costs. And while it might make more environmental sense to go with a different material, it might make less financial sense, and money makes the world go round. Not to get totally cynical, but and of course there are some design firms out there who say, look, we build that into our price. You're going to be paying a higher price, but you're also going to know that your building isn't going to have the same environmental impact as the one across the street. And for some people, that's enough.
Last longer.
That's true. Yes. And it might last longer. It's a great point. So let's talk about greener concrete. Now, one thing you need to know is if you do a Google search for green concrete, one of the things that pops up is the fact that green concrete doesn't necessarily mean eco-friendly concrete, because the American Concrete Institute uses the term green concrete to mean concrete that is hardened or that is set but not yet hardened. Essentially, it's like when you're saying someone is green, you know, meaning that they haven't become a seasoned veteran or whatever. In this case,
green wood.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So not fully ripe. That doesn't mean that there aren't folks trying to make a more eco-friendly concrete. There are plenty out there. And some companies offer alternatives to Portland cement, creating their own type of cement using stuff like landfill waste, which really the biggest one that I've seen is fly ash. Essentially, that's what's left out after you've put stuff through an incinerator. So if you incinerate garbage, then you end up with this ash material. That stuff can actually be used to create cement. So if you're going to be incinerating anyway, not necessarily the best way to get rid of garbage. Again, we're shuffling things around a little bit, but you could at least take that byproduct that's going to exist whether you use it or not and put it to use. There are also mixtures that use fly ash that actually require less water than Portland cement. So then you can have some water conservation in there. And they can also be more resilient. So there are some bonuses there. Then we've got some other kind of cool but not necessarily environmentally beneficial versions of concrete, translucent concrete being one of them. Have you guys ever seen translucent concrete?
No, I don't think I have.
I've seen pictures of it.
Mm-hmm. All you have to do is go to Epcot and Walt Disney World, and you will see translucent concrete if you stick around long enough.
Field trip!
That might sound kind of crazy. Translucent concrete, how could you see through it? I mean, concrete seems like the very definition of opaque. And from what I understand, the concrete itself remains opaque.
Yes.
The issue is that it's embedded with fiber optic material.
Yeah, you put a ton of fiber optics inside the concrete itself, which will allow light to transfer from one side to the other. So it's kind of like translucent concrete, but we're cheating a bit. It'd be like saying that your wall is translucent because you cut some holes in it and you can look through. But what they're doing is they're using these fiber optics. It allows light to transfer from inside to outside, and it creates a much warmer environment than your classic cold concrete. So imagine a building where you're getting some natural light coming in. It's supplementing the light in the area. It's creating a warmer, more welcoming place than you would if you just had cinder block walls.
Yeah, like the glow cloud. It just fills every environment with a sense of peace
all
and belonging.
All hail the glow cloud.
All hail.
So I mentioned that you could see these at Epcot. At Epcot, they have sidewalks that have these translucent concrete paving stones, essentially. And they've got LEDs underneath that can shine through.
Oh, cool.
Kids go nuts because at night you start seeing these patterns and they can have all these different shimmering lights. The lights change color. So it becomes this kind of interactive sidewalk. Not that it's not really interactive because it's all working on like a pre-programmed pattern.
But it's certainly more interactive than a brick of concrete.
Yeah. So kids love it. I loved it. The first time I saw it, I looked at it and thought, how did they do that? And then I realized, oh, it's got to be fiber optic.
But then you came to understand, and all the magic was lost.
And yes, and then I saw, you know, saw the young lady playing Mickey Mouse with the head off in the back parking lot, and it just all fell apart for me. No, actually, people, Mickey Mouse is real. Forget I said anything. In 2004, this was actually supposedly invented. I say supposedly invented in 2004, not that it wasn't invented, but that we're not entirely sure this is actually the origin of translucent concrete. But there was a Hungarian architect, or there is a Hungarian architect by the name of Aaron Lazonczy. And I know I'm brutalizing that last name because I don't speak Hungarian. But at any rate, That was the first person credited for creating this kind of concrete. Beyond that, we've talked about this before, a self-repairing concrete or self-healing concrete. We mentioned that in our December 2013 episode about indestructible materials. We were wondering if that was ever possible to truly create an indestructible material. And we kind of discussed the fact that you're more likely to build stuff that can repair itself somewhat after being damaged. So this kind of concrete typically has one of two things in it, either some form of polymer inside of it or some type of bacteria inside of it. In both cases, that material is activated when it contacts water. So you've got some concrete, a crack forms, water is going to find its way in there because there's
a crack. That's what water does.
Yeah, now you've got a permeable surface. When it contacts that polymer, then the polymer would swell, thus plugging that crack. Or if it contacts bacteria, if it's the bacteria version, the bacteria start to produce something like calcium carbonate, which then fills up the crack. So in either case, you have a system that is filling up cracks. Overall, the strength of the repaired material is not quite as great as it would be without the cracks at all, but it's more than enough to suffice for whatever role you have it. That's the whole purpose of it. And to limit the damage that could happen from an exposed crack that goes unplugged.
Well, that's a great segue to the next thing I wanted to talk about, because this also involves the use of bacteria to create minerals, bacterial production or biogenic production of calcium carbonate.
A lot of bacteria, honestly, are pretty lazy. You know, they don't help you do the dishes. They never vacuum.
Yeah.
Right.
But we can have them help us build concrete materials.
Nice. Yes. So there's a company originally out of North Carolina called BioMason. Good name, by the way.
Yeah.
Good name. Which is based on the idea of building bricks out of the mineralization potential of microorganisms. The founder is named Ginger Dossier, and she came up with the idea by looking at the way coral reefs are built by millions of tiny microorganisms.
Very clever.
Yes, I thought so too. And so one of the things she observes is that the main structural ingredient of coral is going to be calcium carbonate, which is a constituent of limestone, which, if you'll recall from earlier, is a common ingredient in cement. And so the BioMason process goes sort of like this. You start with some sand and you place that in a brick mold. And then you inject the sand with a bacteria colony, with the bacteria Sporosarcina pasturii. And these bacteria are natural producers of calcite. And then you feed the bacteria slash sand mixture a diet of calcium ions in water.
Lovely.
Yeah, delicious. And this causes calcium carbonate to form around the bacteria and makes the sand particles stick together. It takes about 2 to 5 days to grow a brick. That's what they call it, but when the brick hardens into a solid brick. But this doesn't really seem to be any longer than making a clay brick in a kiln.
Cool.
And the process doesn't directly require fuel, which is nice. Also, the idea, and this is the coolest part to me, is that you don't have to make the bricks in one place and then ship them. You can take them, you can essentially make them on site with a powder or a syrup containing the bacterial culture and the other key ingredients using your own sand and water locally sourced.
So that ends up saving you a ton on transportation costs since you're just transporting the actual bacteria to the place that needs to be, and you can buy local for the sand.
And of course, transportation emissions as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of different potential ways to decrease the environmental impact of building material construction.
But there's one really cool potential application of an idea like this. I started to think, wait a second, auto fabrication of building materials on site. That sounds like it could have fantastic implications in space exploration. And what do you know? NASA's on it.
Yeah, go NASA.
Yeah, so in fact, I don't know if this is still in the works, if it's still likely to happen. But in the past, at least in the past few years, some researchers at NASA and elsewhere have discussed the possibility of growing bacterial bricks for construction projects on Mars. And so you might ask, wait a minute, why can't you just ship your bricks to Mars? If you have to ask that, you haven't been listening to this show, but that's okay. Maybe you're new. It would be hilariously expensive. And in terms of energy, I think the term would be profligate.
Hmm. Yeah. Now we've also talked about not just the expense of shipping things, but the idea that, that also is a domino effect, right? Because you're talking about having to use more rocket fuel to get mm-hmm. things. If this is a process where you don't need fuel in the actual process itself, and you have a habitat suitable for this bacteria to thrive in on the Martian landscape, suddenly you have access to a building material production facility on Mars itself.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of those things that's really hard for us to imagine. Like most of the things we talked about when it comes to Mars relate to how do you create a habitat suitable for growing food,
yeah.
for example. We don't really think beyond that. Most of what we talk about is
That's the basic step, yeah.
Yeah,
it's an important one.
Exactly. We don't think about, like, how do we make a factory on Mars? That seems like so far outside the realm of possibility, but...
Or even how do we build a permanent farm on Mars? Because really the best option for farming for us is going to be able to if we're able to build something underground.
Right.
Guess what's really great for building basements?
Yeah, it could very well be that this sort of approach would allow us to shore up a underground cavern, if you will, that would host the habitats that colonists would stay in.
Yeah, because Mars has dirt aplenty.
Yeah.
Right.
They're lousy with it.
So in October 2012, there was an article in New Scientist. I read this about, quote, bug boxes for Mars missions. I like that name. And these are collections of microorganisms. They'd weigh almost nothing, and you can take them with you at very little launch cost in terms of cargo, but they can create colonies of microorganisms that multiply based on resources that are available on the surface of Mars. And there are a lot of possible advantages to synthetic biology. You could construct building materials, of course, but there are other things, like you can make food, necessary chemicals like plastics and antifreeze and stuff you need to do science on Mars. But the creation of the building materials is the one I wanted to focus on now, and it's similar to the Biomason idea. A team led by a Brown graduate named Andre Bernier that was advised by Lynn Rothschild at the Ames Research Center, a few years back, they proposed a way of using that same bacterium I mentioned earlier to make bricks and mortar. And this plays on the idea that the bacterium converts urea, which is found in human urine, into ammonium. And this ammonium increases the pH of the environment so that cements made of calcium carbonate can actually form. It's not too acidic. And so you pee on the bacteria and they help you make bricks out of the Martian gravel and soil.
Oh.
It's the circle of life. It's beautiful.
This is so much cooler than that scene in Waterworld, the opener.
I don't remember what happens.
I just the very first thing you see in Waterworld is Kevin Costner like peeing into a filtration device so that he can drink water.
Yeah, no, this is great too, because like we were talking about with the fly ash, you know, anytime you can make use of a byproduct that is going to be there anyway, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, like with the fly ash, you might argue, well, producing the fly ash is not necessarily that great in the first place. So that's a different argument where you say, how do we get off of systems like incinerators where we're creating a lot of fly ash? And that's equally important to have. But as long as you do have it, you might as well be able to put that stuff to use.
And bacteria aren't the only small organisms that are being investigated for this kind of purpose.
No, sure. How about fungus?
I love a fungus.
I do too. I like eating mushrooms, and I would, I'd make a house out of mushrooms. I could deal with that.
Yeah.
That would be a delicious house.
You'd be a Smurf.
So there's a New York architecture firm called The Living, which I think that was the name of a Radiohead album somewhere back there.
that's a little bit dire,
but
cool.
They're called The Living, and they designed a 40-foot high tower called Hi-Fi, high with a Y, not sure why, made out of about 10,000 bricks consisting of corn fiber and mycelium, fungus. Mycelium is like the root structures that come out of a mushroom, out of fungus.
Mm-hmm.
And this tower was displayed in the PS1 courtyard of the Museum of Modern Art in 2014. So wait a second. How do you build a 40-foot high tower out of mushrooms? Well, with this technique, they made bricks. They made bricks with mushroom binding agents. So the bricks were grown in molds out of organic waste and then seeded with fungus to bind it all together. The bricks took about 5 days to harden into a solid shape. So they're organic, they're biodegradable, which means they're probably not a good candidate for constructing a skyscraper or something like that. But they could be used for construction in buildings meant to last a few years.
Like temporary structures, maybe at a festival or fairground or something like that.
Sure thing, yeah. And these fungus-bound bricks, they can be made without mined materials, without waste products, and without direct carbon emissions. So I think that's a pretty cool idea. They're still being developed, so I'd say you should look out for more on this in the future.
Another thing that you might want to look out for is hemp composites. Yes, hemp as in marijuana, that kind of thing indeed, friends. Yeah. So the inner, like, wood-like cores of hemp stalks are called herds. Information I did not know previously.
H-U-R-D-S.
Herds. And these can be processed and then mixed with minerals like lime or cement to create a building material that can actually be carbon negative because the manufacturing process can be offset by the growth of the hemp plants to begin with. Honestly, y'all, right now, most of the information about hemp architecture materials is being provided by private companies who have a vested interest in making the stuff sound really great.
Sure.
So I don't want to report any facts and figures that could be biased.
Right. Yeah. There could be a lot of cherry picking going on.
Right. Well, sure. That's a thing we definitely get into with these ideas about alternative building materials.
Right.
So we know the problems with the stuff most people are selling, but then also a lot of the solutions are coming from people who are trying to sell something as well. So
right.
it's worth remembering, even though they're preaching a message of sustainability, which is a good thing, you should always be wary
thinking.
And it's not that we're saying that necessarily any of these people are lying about stuff.
Right.
They went into this business because they believe strongly in the technology that they're developing, and
right.
that's wonderful and beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
But just watch out for it. Critical thinking is always good. And I would say that it's going to be extremely interesting in the next few years as perhaps laws, specifically here in the U.S., begin to allow the growth of hemp to see whether more companies start investigating this as a source.
Now, I will say I'm a little worried because William Randolph Hearst told me that any building made out of hemp would gradually drive me insane.
Yeah, that building would pick up an axe and slay your grandmother.
That I would also listen to jazz music. I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff that go along with it.
Not jazz music.
I think it's time to talk about wool and seaweed.
Oh, Minecraft.
What?
Building out of wool.
Tell me.
Minecraft. You can do that in Minecraft.
Neither of us play Minecraft, but that's
okay.
Great.
Tell me about it.
Yes.
So yeah, you use shears and you shear sheep and then you get a cubic meter. I don't know how a sheep produces a cubic meter, sometimes 2 cubic meters.
Look, sheep
of wool.
Are mystical and impressive creatures.
Yes, but
I have a question.
Yes.
I have a question about Minecraft. In Minecraft,
yeah.
Do materials have compression resistance properties?
Well.
So, like, if you build a castle with a foundation made of wool, will that stand?
Yes. That part, the compression of wool is not to be questioned. It is just as good as obsidian, which is one of the strongest materials in the game.
Amazing.
However, they do have some compression effects because now you can build with slime and it's bouncy.
Oh,
but,
boy.
Pardon my cough in the background. You guys couldn't see me, but I was laughing so hard that I just kind of started coughing over here. Please continue.
Well, let's talk about actual real world uses of wool, because while I love building stuff with wool in Minecraft, if there's a thunderstorm and lightning strikes it, it goes up in flames.
Oh, no. Well, no, I do want to mention this, not because this is the one example of the brick that's going to save the future, but there are all kinds of studies about how to make better composite materials.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a tradition that goes back to ancient times. You could make a brick in the ancient world by mixing mud and straw. There you've got a composite material. You've got a binding agent, and you've got this straw in between that helps strengthen it. And one of the things that I came across that I thought was pretty interesting is this example of wool and seaweed. So in 2010, in the journal Construction and Building Materials, there was an article called Clay-Based Composite Stabilized with Natural Polymer and Fiber. And this was a cool experiment. They found that for unfired earthen bricks, so the ones that you don't have to cook, you can significantly increase compression resistance if you introduce a couple things. Alginate, I'm assuming that's a hard G, not alginate, but it's alginate, which is a biomaterial found in the cell walls of brown algae seaweed.
Huh.
This is common brown seaweed you see in the ocean. And sheep's wool. And these bricks were designed so they didn't have to be fired. Like I said, that's an energy saver. And they can be made from locally available excess biomaterials in the UK. So you got your sheep, you got extra wool left over from the textile industry, and then you've got your seaweed. Nobody's really using that. You press all that together with your earthen agent in the brick, and this makes a much stronger brick.
Huh, this is... The thing that this is reminding me of, other than Minecraft, is Settlers of Catan.
Right.
No, suddenly, sheep are becoming a building resource. Yeah.
Yeah. You don't need that brick tile. You can just get some sheep and some. Well, I guess there is no seaweed tile.
Well, but you can turn your sheep into bricks. This is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm seeing the conversion there. Yeah.
Right.
Well, another thing you could turn your sheep into: bricks made of animal blood.
Wow. So you could...
That is the gothest thing I have heard.
Yeah, you could build a cathedral out of animal blood.
Pretty sure there's a Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds song coming out from here.
Okay, so no, I want to say that I think this experiment is not necessarily the future. I really doubt we're going to have buildings made entirely out of animal blood, except maybe as an art project. But it's just too good of a principle not to mention, since it has been demonstrated. The bricks are made of animal blood. In 2012... there were some news stories about a British architect named Jack Monroe who decided to experiment with creating building materials out of about the ickiest form of bio-waste you can imagine, fresh blood from slaughtered animals.
Oy.
And so this kind of makes sense in a way, actually. Animal blood is a prolific industrial byproduct that often goes to waste.
Absolutely.
Just discarded or incinerated.
Yeah.
And blood has components that encourage bonding under the right circumstances. Like, so blood in the past has been used as a type of glue. And so you look at that and you say, well, maybe we could get some useful, some utility out of this.
Mm-hmm.
And so Monroe claimed that he could make strong, waterproof bricks with the following process. You mix fresh animal blood with an acid called EDTA, which is a preservative agent. I'm not going to try to pronounce the entire chemical name unless, Jonathan, do you want to try to say it?
Oh, man, I'm just looking at it right now. ask me again at the end of the show.
Okay.
Ethylene diamine tetraethyl. Oh, it's almost there.
Yeah. Once you get to ethylene.
I can say ethylene.
Diamine tetracetic acid. Ethylene diamine tetracetic acid.
Not bad.
Yeah.
Not bad. Yeah, so there you go. It's a preservative. It's used to prevent the blood from growing some organisms in it, which you wouldn't want in the walls of your house.
Not necessarily.
And then you mix that blood with sand, and then you bake the mixture. And you don't have to bake it very hot. 70 degrees Celsius is good enough. That'll work, and it'll coagulate the proteins in the blood. It holds the sand together, and bam, you have a brick.
Wow.
Somebody should make something out of these bricks.
This is really important. You guys, I wear a lot of black eyeliner sometimes, and I absolutely need to see this in action.
Yeah. I'm just, every horror movie I've ever seen is starting to come to mind right now.
Yeah, that too.
Especially the ghost ones where, you know, like the walls are bleeding.
Yeah.
But obviously that's not what would happen with this stuff. That would be the binding agent, just as cement was with concrete. It's not like it would be in any sort of liquid form. It would be completely solid. It is an interesting point. Again, like the idea being that if you have this byproduct that otherwise is going to waste, if you can put it to use, isn't that better than just throwing it out or incinerating it?
Right.
Now, it comes down to the kind of stereotypical thing you would say about the settlers of America versus the Native Americans, the idea that the Native Americans would use the entire buffalo That's something that if you study the frontier stories of America, you often hear that.
Oh, yeah. And it's even kind of popular within the food movement these days, is a return from, you know, like snout to tail kind of dining, where if you're going to kill an animal in order to eat something, I mean, A, make it tasty, and B, use all the parts, even the weird ones that people, especially in America these days, aren't used to eating anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. So
it reminds me actually of a story I saw that we had a House to Forks Now article about recently, which is using rejected tomatoes for energy.
Right. Right. The idea of being able to use something.
They're not good enough to eat.
But. Yeah. Using something that, for example, a tomato that has burst through the, you know, when you're harvesting it, you damage the tomato.
Mm-hmm.
You can't sell that. Right. So, but if you can still make use of it, then that's great because you're taking something that was once waste and turning it into a resource. So while this definitely is hitting me in certain psychological ways because I find it kind of creepy just based upon my own personal feelings,
mm-hmm.
I totally appreciate the fact that, again, it's a waste not, want not kind of approach to creating building materials. Now, we were just covering a small slice of potential future building materials, specifically ones that have a biological component to them.
Yeah, I mean, we could do whole episodes probably on building materials featuring additions of graphene or carbon nanotubes.
Right, polymers, getting back into more of the various advanced plastics that are out there.
Advanced ceramics, yeah.
Yeah.
Aerogel. Mm.
Yes, aerogel's really fascinating stuff, too. So we've got a lot of other topics in this realm that we will cover in the future.
Yeah.
Obviously, we're not.
We'll come back to this.
Yeah, we're not going to do. I don't think we're going to do like 3 months of future building materials, but we will occasionally revisit this topic.
Yeah, yeah.
But that leads me to another question. Guys, if you have a specific type of topic, or maybe it's a large one like building materials, and you would like to hear us start to do a series on that, or maybe it's something very particular and specific, just go ahead and send us a question. But in order for us to be able to answer it, we have to be able to read it. So use this email address, fwthinking@howstuffworks.com, or drop us a line on Twitter or Facebook. At Twitter, we are fwthinking. You can search fwthinking in Facebook. Our page will pop right up. You can leave us a message there, and we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
Ladies and gentlemen,
we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars for the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
It's brand new season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Vilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can't fully understand the moment we're living in without knowing where we've been. On every episode of NPR's Throughline, we take a story from the news and go back in time to where it started, where it really started. To answer one important question, how did we get here? Find NPR's Throughline on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Good, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.